rodeo is a big deal in Texas.
Got a rematch on the horse called Guns Blazing. He was 88 points at the Snake River Stampede in Nampa, Idaho.
And Rodeo Houston is the largest livestock show and rodeo in the world.
That 88 would be great right now.
And they've been 88 twice on this horse this year already.
Guns Blazing is a bucking bronco. She's a powerful horse whose whole job is to try to throw her rider. To do that, she bucks and kicks and twists her body as she leaps high into the air.
Violets, Guns Ablazing with the servings.
On this day in Houston, her rider closes his fist over a thick braided rein as his bronco explodes out of the chute.
Too quiet out there. Ride with him.
Guns Blazing surges forward, head low, hind legs snapping toward the ceiling of the stadium where the Houston Texans play football during the NFL season. And when she snaps her legs, her rider's head jolts back each time she bucks. And then it slams forward when she lurches ahead.
I'm on Kansas! Uh-oh! Head down! Boom!
She hurls her rider to the ground.
Horse steps on his back on the way out. And the first one to him is the guy that owns the horse, Binion Servi.
Face down in the dirt, the rider writhes in pain.
Ooh, folks, you believe in prayer? Go ahead and say one. Sure can't hurt.
Rodeo is a dangerous sport. Saddle bronc riding, bareback bronc riding, bull riding. Cowboys get thrown.
Is he standing up?
And they get up again.
Hey, have you ever heard the saying, cowboy tough? How about giving Weston a round of applause for being cowboy tough?
An athlete will generally get medical care for an injury like this. The dramatic ones we all see, but what many don't seem to know is that even a clean ride, where you don't hit your head at all, is dangerous to the brain. Every buck, twist, and leap slams the brain against the rider's skull. Scientists call them head acceleration events, and in saddle bronc riding, more than half of them happen without hitting their head on anything, just a skull being violently redirected again and again for each of the 8 seconds of their ride. Traumatic brain injuries are easier to get and far more common than most people realize, and more than half of people who get a TBI don't realize they've gotten one. And that's a problem because even a mild TBI can change the trajectory of a person's life. So how do we catch brain injuries that don't seem to be serious or aren't accompanied by hitting your head on something? Dr. Monica Verduzco-Gutierrez is an expert in brain injury medicine, and she's part of a team that has developed new guidelines, not for sports medicine doctors or neurologists who deal with serious head injuries every day, but for the primary care physicians and other frontline providers who are most likely to see patients who may not recognize they've hurt their brain. She joined me for a deep dive into traumatic brain injury. That's next. From Texas Public Radio, this is Petri Dish. I'm Buddy Petri.
Support for TPR comes from the University of Texas at San Antonio's Brain Health Consortium, a pioneering research hub advancing neuroscience, neuroengineering, precision medicine, and more. Learn more at utsa.edu/BHC.
I was hesitant to start this show with rodeo because most people will never ride a bucking bronco or a bull, right? They are not going to get tossed into the air like a rag doll and land face down in the dirt in front of hundreds or thousands of people. But a study from late last year found that in the event with which we started the show, saddle bronc riding, By far, the greatest threat to riders' brains are the injuries caused by snapping their heads back and forth, not getting thrown. They're the kinds of injuries that don't land you in the hospital, but still do damage. And you don't have to be a bronc rider to be vulnerable to this type of injury. You could get one in a fender bender or on an amusement park ride or even just from a hard fall. And that's who's been slipping through the cracks. Regular folks who bruise their brain somehow, but it goes undetected and untreated, which can lead to lifelong symptoms in people who will not get the care and support that they need. Dr. Monica Verduzco Gutierrez is a professor and chair in the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at UT Health San Antonio, which is the academic health center of the University of Texas at San Antonio. And she was part of a group of experts brought together by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine that set out to fix that by creating a clear set of guidelines for doctors to follow to catch more cases of TBI and get people the kind of care that will improve their outcomes. So, Doc, let's just begin with the basics. How do you define a traumatic brain injury?
So, a traumatic brain injury is when someone usually has an impact to their brain, and often they're hit against something, they're in a car accident, they fall, they get a jolt of their head, and then it doesn't mean just because you hit your head, you had a traumatic brain injury. Usually there's something else that goes on, like a change of consciousness, a period of dizziness, of confusion. And so once those two things happen, it's considered a traumatic brain injury.
And I think it's important to talk about people who get a TBI who jolt their brain but don't actually hit their head. You taught me about this, the subconcussive force. Talk to us about that.
So as far as subconcussive forces, it can actually be sometimes people who work on like construction and have these things that are just like shaking their bodies a lot of time. Bull riders who have to like, maybe they're not getting thrown off, but you're still like, your brain, it's almost like jello. You can see the jello moving back and forth in this fixed box.
Like a construction worker who works at jackhammer and their brain is just sort of rattling around in their skull while they break up pavement. That can cause micro traumas that add up eventually. So you can get a TBI when you hit your head and your brain slams against your skull, or when you don't hit your head, but it jerks hard enough for your brain to slam against your skull, or you do something that vibrates your brain long enough and hard enough to cause problems.
Our skull is, you know, this hard bone, and inside we have our brain, and that's surrounded by fluid. And so if you get hit, it's almost like you think of maybe ice and water, that there's pieces of ice there or a big chunk of ice. And if you shake your cup, the ice hits the edges. Well, it's the same thing that can happen to our brain inside our hard skull. And there's even parts of our skull on the inside, like the bottom part, that actually has really rough edges. And so we've been researching it for very many years, with research coming out in the last several years that even mild brain injuries or concussions can cause some longer-term effects.
Yeah, so these ideas that we had when I was a kid and I played soccer and my brothers played football, and it was sort of a badge of honor to get back on the field once you got your bell rung, as my dad would say. And my brother told me about scoring touchdowns he did not remember after going back on the field after hitting his head. I think a lot of people hit their heads and just sort of get on with their day and really don't think it's a big deal, but it could be.
Exactly. Because actually, more than half of these patients, they're never seen. They never get the right kind of care.
So what are the potential consequences of a traumatic brain injury?
So from TBI, it can be physical deficits. So sometimes if someone's brain injury is severe enough, they can have weakness in one side of their body or in all parts of their body. They can have certain types of movement disorders. It can also affect cognition. So that means anything from a whole realm of things. You know, is your short-term memory gone? Is some of your long-term memory? Is there processing speed issues? Is there word-finding issues? There's so many things that can go on with cognitive. There is psychosocial, meaning, you know, does your personality change? Do you develop a new mood disorder? Is there behavioral issues? And those are some of the more severe things. And then it can affect your function and your quality of life and your ability to work. So someone may not be able to participate in work and their community activities. So really, it's a whole range that TBI can affect. And then some things that we don't maybe think of on the top of our head, but we see more and more. And even with people who've had mild TBIs or concussions later on in life are going to be at increased risk of some cardiovascular risk factors like getting high blood pressure and also mood disorders like having depression later on.
I was surprised to learn that if you get a TBI, a brain injury, you increase your risk of developing cardiovascular issues like hypertension, stroke, and damage to your blood vessels. So if you've injured your brain, you definitely want to know about it. And you definitely want to follow up with your primary care doctor so they can, you know, keep an eye on things and get you to the right specialist if you need them. So is that what the new guidelines are for?
So specifically, these new guidelines that we came up with were kind of for that patient population where they had the traumatic brain injury. Maybe they got seen in the emergency room or in urgent care, and then they're kind of sent home, or maybe they go to their PCP within a few days. And they weren't really good guidelines for that patient population. We have really great guidelines for athletes. We have great guidelines for, you know, severe brain injury. Of course, if you have a very severe brain injury and you end up, you know, in the hospital, then you're going to be getting CT scans and having surgery and those types of things. But what about that little gray area in the middle? So these are something for primary care physicians. They're seeing these patients. They're like, hey, you know, I hit my head. I've been feeling off. I've not been feeling well. So here are the guidelines for them. And so really urgent care kind of physicians, primary care, frontline physicians, we want to have these guidelines.
Okay, so what are they?
The first thing was confirm the diagnosis, because not always hit in the head is a brain injury. So it's like confirming the diagnosis and giving the person the diagnosis and then determining if they need a higher level of care or an emergency visit. Please go get, you know, a scan or whatever it may be. And not everyone with them, especially these mild TBIs, need a scan. And so when do you need to request neuroimaging, or when is there needed a more in-depth neuropsychological testing? When is it indicated? That's also part of the guidelines.
The next guideline is about social determinants of health, which you lobbied to include, right? Social determinants of health are factors in a person's life that aren't health-related but influence their health nonetheless, like socioeconomic status and economic stability, access to education, the quality of healthcare to which they have access, where they live.
It's probably one of the first guidelines that actually asks to screen for social determinants of health, because this is also something we see that majorly impacts outcomes. Do they have family supports? Do they have insurance? Do they have a good type of insurance that provides all the therapies they need, or do they have, you know, the minimum, or can they not qualify for anything because of, you know, their financial situation or whatever else it may be? And then can they get around? Is there support groups? Because sometimes it's very isolating. And we realize that even when their brain injury isn't that severe, they still sometimes are isolated and that they don't get out, you know, they're not out in the community as much as they should be.
The next guideline is about when and how to resume normal activities after whatever recovery period your doctor has recommended.
Yeah, so we see it in the NFL all the time. Oh, they're on the concussion protocol for returning to sport. But do we have that for work or for getting back to school? So that's part of the guidelines. There's guidelines on educating and educating the patient and the family in words they understand, in ways they can read and understand it. Patients after TBI have, some of them have a risk of persisting symptoms. And so we're realizing what are the groups of people who are at risk of persisting symptoms, educating on that, and then which of those symptoms to prioritize first, and then also screening for and treating mental health disorders.
I want to take a deeper dive into the mental health issues associated with TBI because it's kind of personal to me. So let's take a break and we'll talk about that when Petri Dish continues.
Support for Petri Dish is made possible by UT Health San Antonio's Mays Cancer Center, South Texas NCI-designated cancer center, providing cancer care for patients, advancing research, and educating the next generation of leaders. Mays Cancer Center is working to end cancer in South Texas and beyond. Learn more at mayscancercenter.org.
If you like this kind of reporting, consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or on whatever podcast app you use. That's one way to tell people that if they want compelling content about science, medicine, and health, Petri Dish is a good choice. Now, back to the show. When people think of Kanye West, now known as Ye, they might think about the MTV Music Awards back in 2009.
Yo, Taylor, I'm really happy for you. I'm gonna let you finish. But Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time.
Or that network fundraiser for Hurricane Katrina, where he stood next to a stunned Mike Myers and said,
George Bush doesn't care about black people.
Or this.
As you probably could have guessed by this moment, I have decided in 2020 to run for president.
Or his more recent string of vicious anti-Semitic ravings and other rants about a variety of conspiracy theories. But I think about this.
Everybody says, who does he think he is? I just told you who I thought I was, a god.
And this.
You say, whatever, just give him that bipolar medication. Y'all try to kill the superheroes. But we here, we alive. You know what I'm saying?
And this.
God would rather be dead, not in jail. Because I'd rather be dead than to be on medication.
And then I get emotional because I think about my brother. The intensity, the grandiosity, the paranoia and persecutory delusions, the desperation, the tempo of his words. It all reminds me of my brother. And like Ye, my brother had a neglected head injury. My brother got a fractured skull when he was about 8, and then he went on to play hockey and football for years. Ye got into a serious car accident decades ago. He told Charlie Rose all about it back in 2005.
And I think I had about a 10-minute ride to the hotel, and I fell asleep at the wheel, and I was woken by a steering wheel hitting my mouth at 50 miles per hour. So I thought it was just broken in one place, and I found out later it was broken in 3 places.
So I've always had a lot of compassion for Kanye. I had a hunch he had bipolar disorder years before he acknowledged it publicly, only because he reminded me so much of my brother. And it has been difficult to watch his mental health deteriorate over the last decade through his 40s. I admit it's probably easier to feel compassion when someone isn't, you know, targeting their dangerous vitriol at you or your community. But I watched my brother's mental health deteriorate in a similar way throughout his 40s. So I felt compassion. So when Ye bought a full page ad in Wall Street Journal in January of 2026 to publish an apology essay called To Those I've Hurt, I was interested in what he had to say. It was about his head injury. He wrote that at the time of his car accident, the focus was on the visible damage to his jaw and his face, while the injury inside his skull went unnoticed and untreated. This, he wrote, later led to his bipolar 1 diagnosis, and then in early 2025, a 4-month manic episode that included, quote, psychotic, paranoid, and impulsive behavior that destroyed his life. Now, there are a lot of people who have no interest in why he did what he did and said what he said, and that's fair. I know what TBI can do, and I'm inclined to think there's something to what he says. We've been talking to Dr. Monica Verduzco Gutierrez, an expert in brain injury medicine. And while she hasn't met Ye and obviously can't diagnose him, I asked her if what he claims is possible. Could a 25-year-old TBI cause a mood disorder?
It is definitely possible, yes. And, you know, there's other factors and there's psychosocial factors and what's happening around you, but it is definitely possible.
How does that work?
So if your brain has an injury, then there is something that's called neuroplasticity. So that means our brain's going to try to rewire itself. But there is still, you had the injury at the time. There is inflammation related to that injury at that time. There's things happening at a, you know, a cellular microscopic level that we may not be able to see. And sometimes even with those changes, even though our brain's trying to rewire itself and fix itself, there is going to sometimes be a propensity that things don't align the way they should, or it increases your risk of having mental health conditions or personality changes.
In my research for the show, I learned that if you get a head injury at 8, when my brother got his skull fracture, it can change the trajectory of a child's development in a lot of ways, causing cognitive, emotional, and behavioral issues that may not show up right away.
Yeah, there can be some link with having traumatic brain injury when someone's young and then having psychiatric conditions later in life, for sure.
One part of Ye's letter that really gutted me was the part about how people with bipolar disorder have a shorter lifespan by 10 to 15%. Ye is 48. My brother died when he was 49. His autopsy doesn't mention his mental health, but it does link his death to his original childhood head injury, which had apparently started bleeding more than 40 years later. He died of a subdural hematoma in that location. I'm not sure whether my parents knew that his head injury could cause all these kinds of challenges. I don't know that anybody did back in the 80s. I do know they didn't do any of the follow-up we now know a person with TBI might need for the rest of their life. His TBI didn't even come up when he started having seizures as an adult. Now we know more, and hopefully the guidelines Dr. Verduzco Gutierrez helped write will change outcomes.
I mean, the hope is that it will change outcomes because people are going to be able to get the appropriate care they need, ones that might need more imaging, ones that need treatment for their symptoms, get people back to work and back to school appropriately, because these people have actually instructions and guidelines to get help that if they have their social determinants screened for, like you may recommend something, but if they don't have resources to do that, how do you help get them resources in the community to follow through? And then hopefully in the end, you know, promoting better outcomes after head injury.
Right. And it's not dealt with like my parents did. And I know they did their best. But once my brother healed from that initial injury, it's like we never really thought about it again.
People treat traumatic brain injury as an event, but it isn't. It's a lifelong chronic condition. And so that means resources, therapies, access to care should be lifelong. It shouldn't just be at that time of event.
And I think the world isn't really built for people who have disabilities related to TBI. So what can we do to make the world easier to navigate for folks who are challenged in this way?
Yeah, great question. And yes, one thing with TBI is that it looks so different for any person that has a TBI. You might have someone who is very severe and they're in a wheelchair. They can't move any part of their body. And then you have someone that looks like a regular person on the outside, but on the inside, they have cognitive issues, processing issues, and the world may think they look fine, and why are you having trouble speaking or thinking? And so really people can look different ways with a traumatic brain injury, and the world needs to be accessible. We need to have access for them to get care. There's not that many physicians that are specialized in brain injury medicine. There's also sometimes hard to access to even primary care or primary care that may fully understand what, you know, people with traumatic brain injuries needs are going to be. We have to make sure that there's enough, you know, therapy resources for these patients. And as far as communities, we have to have communities that are going to be accessible, and accessibility is a big, big piece.
And like with a lot of chronic conditions, if you can't go back to work, you're going to struggle to access many of the resources that are really kind of non-negotiable in your recovery or just to live your life.
Right. You see that happen a lot, that someone, they're working, they have a brain injury, they can't work anymore. And then you have to apply for disability and for Medicaid or Medicare. But even that, it can take 2 years to get on Medicare once you apply for disability. And so there could be this period of time where there's no resources for you or you don't have insurance.
So how do we strengthen the safety net?
So as far as improving the safety net, I know there are some organizations, like even locally in San Antonio, there's an organization, the nonprofit that's called Connectability, and they do try to work with people who have traumatic neurologic injuries and work with them to help connect them with resources in the community. There's locally the Alamo Head Injury Association. They have support groups. They have information sessions. They have educational sessions. They have resources for people online. You also have to have some health literacy to know to look up these things as well.
And not everybody has that, unfortunately. There is a national organization called the Brain Injury Association of America. It has state chapters. You can Google it, and I will put a link at tpr.org. But I feel like this is one of those situations where an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So how do you protect your brain from injury in the first place?
I think for brain protection, you start early and you really have to think about the activities that you're doing. If you're out riding a bike, yeah, it's great. Wear a helmet. You know, if you are in a car, wear your seatbelt. Don't drink and drive. Really be careful with contact sports. There's this, something I read recently, and it was about football. And I know we're in Texas and everyone loves football, but it was actually saying like there is an age where you shouldn't be playing contact football before a certain age.
The Centers for Disease Control recommends that athletes younger than 14 play flag football, no contact, to reduce their risk of developing CTE, which is chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is what you hear about pro football players getting, and also to protect them from the kind of severe head injuries that can lead to outcomes like my brother's.
But even on what you consider is a not severe, you know, people are like, it was just a concussion. I just got my bell rung. Long-term can cause problems as well. So really, you have to protect your brain. It's so important.
I'll try. Thank you so much, Dr. Gutierrez. That's Dr. Monica Verduzco Gutierrez, a professor and the chair of the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at UT Health San Antonio, the Academic Health Center of the University of Texas at San Antonio. This episode of Petri Dish was produced by Jacob Rosati, TPR Vice President of News Dan Katz, and me. I researched, reported, and wrote the show. Jacob composed all the music, created the sound design, and edited the script. Petri Dish is a production of Texas Public Radio. I'm Bonnie Petri. Talk to you soon.